Welcome to Hey Chaplain. My name is Jared Altick, and I'm a chaplain with the police department. This podcast exists so that cops can hear encouragement for the tough work that they do. It's my mission to bring encouragement and wisdom to police officers all around the world, mostly by interviewing other cops. So on this podcast, you'll hear from detectives and dispatchers, U.S. Marshals and county sheriffs, and the occasional federal agent. From the LAPD to Scotland Yard, the guests on Hey Chaplain give you their hard-earned wisdom so that you don't have to do everything the hard way. This show is commercial-free because listeners who want to encourage cops partner with me and support the show by buying me a $5 virtual coffee at buymeacoffee.com/heychaplain. You don't have to do that. You already get the show for free. But thank you for making it possible for police officers to hear something positive. Today, we're talking to Simon Osimo, who was a highly decorated detective in the UK. He investigated organized crime and was also doing some counterterrorism stuff. In fact, if you've ever had a container of liquid confiscated at the airport, then you're familiar with the results of Simon's work. Today, he's talking to us about communication and empathy, about mentors in law enforcement, and how the presence or absence of our fathers affects us all, both law enforcement and criminals. Here's Simon Osimo. Hello, Simon. How are you today?
Jared, really excited to be having this conversation with you. Looking forward to sharing part of my UK police journey with your audience.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm so glad to have you. So tell me a little bit about how you got started in law enforcement. Why did you become a police officer?
Well, I would say, maybe many officers say this, Jared, but I would say that I fell into law enforcement more than actually... I'll just start with saying that I fell into it. So what happened, I can recall being like 14, 15 years old, where you watch the cop shows, don't you? And they, you know, they always get the bad guy and it's very fun and exciting. So I had a bit of an interest in law enforcement just from TV and the movies. But a little bit different than many officers, perhaps in the US, I became a police officer at 19 years old. And actually, I was working in residential care for adults with learning disabilities. Growing up, one of my foster brothers has learning disabilities. So I had a strong interest in sort of helping those that are sort of mentally disabled in some way. And I was working at this home, this residential care home. And the next door neighbor to the house was a senior ranking police officer. And I was just talking to him one day, and I was, you know, an 18-year-old young kid. And he said, you know, is this what you want to do with your career? And I said, well, actually, I've got quite an interest in being in the police. And I said, I did apply a little while ago, and I didn't hear anything. And then his name was Charlie Nelson. And he said to me, he said, my office is next door to the recruitment agent. He said, let me find out where your application is. And Jared, he must have done something because I hadn't heard for like 6 months. And then like the following week, I had a letter saying that we've accepted your application. Come in for testing. And I went through the testing, was successful. Went through all the different interviews and was successful. And there I was as a 19-year-old kid, as a police officer, thinking, how on earth did this happen? So I sort of, I fell into the profession, I say. But it very much... It made me the person I am today, so I'm very grateful for the opportunities being a police officer afforded me.
Sure. So when you first become a police officer in the UK, do you start out, do you have any control over where you go? Do you start out in your hometown? Do they move you around?
So it's a good question. So it's very different being a UK police officer than what you might have here in America. So, you know, each state is different, but in the UK, you do go to the academy. So I had to apply to become police officer, be successful for a series of interviews. I then went to my home force, which was Thames Valley Police. I went there for 5 weeks. Then I went off for 15 weeks to a residential training facility. Then after that 15 weeks, I then went back to my station where I was going to be for 5 weeks. Then I then went back to the academy again for a further 10 weeks. And then you go on 2 years probation. So by the time you've sort of been on the streets, you've really had most probably at least 5 or 6 months of dedicated training into you. And to answer your question about where you end up,
right?
There was two trains of thought. So I actually put down, I ended up policing the area where I live, which many officers would always be saying, no, Simon, don't do that. And you know, your non-police listeners are thinking, well, maybe that was a good thing to do. So you could request free areas. So I know my first one was Reading Police Station, which is the area that I grew up. I can't remember where my second or my third choice was, but I was a 19-year-old kid policing the area where I was born and raised. So I came across numerous people that I went to school with in some way, or, you know, there's many times that I stopped someone in a car that I'd gone to school with and they're saying, Simon, can you let us off? And I'm this 19-year-old saying, I can't do that. You've got to go through the system. So, yeah.
One of the things about your story that I find interesting is when you have talked about having a mentor and the importance of having a mentor, somebody who could guide you, not just through your life, but also guide you through your police career. Can you give me a couple examples of where that happened for you?
Yeah. So, you know, part of my journey, and I share it very openly, I was born to a white English mother and my father is black Nigerian. My parents separated before I was born. So as a Christian, this is something that I sort of wrestled with. My mother never remarried, so never really had any sort of male role models. And I guess Charlie Nelson that I mentioned, when I said to him one day how I had an interest of applied for the police, and he said, well, my office is next door to the recruitment. I think there's been these sort of strong men that have come into my life. And I think because of my upbringing, raised in very humble beginnings. My mum used to foster children to make a living. So we've had like 30 or 40 foster children that came into my house, lived in social housing. You know, there's many different forms of adversity, Jared, I've gone through in my life. I think being in the police force was definitely the making of me. And there's been twists and turns where, because I haven't had this absent father, there's been people in my life that have been correcting me or course correcting me. And one of those was a senior ranking officer. So when I left the police, I was a detective sergeant. And anyone that watches UK police dramas, this officer was a detective chief superintendent, which is a very senior ranking detective. And I think I was 21 or 22, because I was a detective by 23, very young. I'd applied for a firearms position. And this detective chief superintendent, Melvin Young, the chief of police was out, who had to sort of approve my application. He was out for whatever reason, and it landed on Melvin Young's desk because it needed a senior leader to sign off on my application for the firearms team. And he called me and said, Simon, can you come to work? And I was like, you know, I'm like 21, 22, Jan. I'm like, coming to work. It's like, it's not my day off. Why am I going to come in to work? He said, well, I've got your application. I'd like to talk to you about it. And, you know, and I was said, I was 21, 20, had to be 21 or 22 because I was a detective at 23. You know, and I sort of walk in his office and he sort of says, Simon, you know, I've got your application and I'm happy to sign off that I think you would be good on the firearms team. However, I've been watching you. I've been hearing about some of the things that you've been doing. I think you'd be a better fit as a detective. And I gave it, I'm sure your listeners can, everyone said this at one time in their life. I gave it the, with respect, sir, you know, thank you, but that's not really what I want to do. You know, the respect as in, you don't know what you're talking about, sir.
So was the firearms team a, like what we would call a SWAT team? Like was
correct.
It a special response team?
Yes, so it would have been like a SWAT team, yeah. Okay. You know, and again, it was that I was a young guy, you know, it sounded exciting, you know, jumping out.
Lots of young cops want to be on that team.
Lots of young cops, you know, want to be on that team. And I can remember, so we had this conversation. I left it with the, with respect, sir, thank you for your time, but that's not, you know, an area that I want to go. And I think he left a little bit bemused thinking, this young guy. And then...
How much older was he than you?
Oh, he must have been late or mid-40s at the time. And, you know, like I said, I was 21, 22. And then my detective chief inspector, he then spoke to me and he said, Simon, he said, the applications are coming in for detective. And Chief Superintendent Melvin Yarnes said that you haven't applied. And I said, the same as I said to him, with respect, sir, I don't intend to apply. And he said, Simon, he said, you don't get it, do you? I said, no. I said, I must be missing something here. What am I missing? He said, he wasn't asking you to apply. He was telling you to apply. And then that nudge led me to apply to become a detective. And when I left Thames Valley Police, serving just short of 14 years, I was awarded a commendation by the chief of police, I think on no fewer than 14 occasions, which was, at the time I left, was almost unheard of in a police department that has around 6,000 sworn officers. I had a very good career. And that was for me, Jared. That was a time when a few things happened that day. One, that was a positive male role model in my life. But it was also someone that saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. As a young kid, that was a great skill, or maybe not skill is the wrong word. That was a great observation to have, because in my life since, as I mentioned, growing up without a father, living in troubled times, that course correct that I had as a man of faith has allowed me to then say, well, where do I see that in other individuals? And even I've been at Target before at the talking to the cashier, and as a young guy then I'm saying, you know, is this what you want to do with your life? Yeah, he said, no, I want to be an entrepreneur, I want to do these things. You know, he says to me, what do you do now? I'm saying, well, I'm an entrepreneur, you know, and I sort of give him my business card and say, if ever you need any help and assistance, you know, let me know. Because I think it's really important to, when you see things in people they might not see in themselves, is to share that with them, because it most often can have a sequence of events which can change and catapult their life.
When these supervisors, these senior officers, when they said, hey, you really should do this, we're not really asking as much as we're telling you, at what point did you get on board? I mean, well, what point was your heart in it to become a detective?
Yeah, good. I think one of the blessings that I had as a police officer, maybe because I joined young and because of my upbringing, is no matter who was in front of me, it didn't matter. I mean, and I've interviewed a guy who's murdered his son because his son was going to expose him as a pedophile. I've interviewed numerous murderers. I've interviewed all these bad peoples. But I always looked at them as being human beings. And I used to say, there but for the grace of God go I. But we can all say that we might have made a wrong turn, or we've made a mistake or done something that we later regret. And we all have regrets in life. We've all done things that I've done a lot of things that I'm ashamed of in my life. But I think that attitude or that observation in myself is what really said to me, actually, Simon, you can be quite good at this. Because what Melvin Young saw in me and other people did is I would have conversations with these hardened criminals and I would get them to admit their guilt. Or, you know, for some people, they might come in shouting and screaming and want to fight. And then I would interact with them and say, hey, Simon, how you doing today? Yeah, I haven't seen you in a while. And people would look at me and just say, you know, how are you talking to these guys? I'm like, well, I'm just talking to them, right? They're just sort of human beings. And I think that was the term when I realized that I could sort of use that gift of communication to help victims of crime be successful. And I used to really enjoy that as a detective, using those skills to really understand not so much what this person did, but what got you there? How did you get on this path? What started you on this path of crime, of violence, or whatever it was? And I used to find, Jared, a lot of them, treating them with that respect, they used to like sharing their stories and telling me how it came about. And what I used to discover through that is that they weren't too dissimilar to me. They had an absent father. They had troubled times. No one believed in them. No one had faith in them. They struggled in school. You know, they had all these different things that I could relate to. And that was when I really thought, maybe this is more than a job here. This is a vocation. Yeah.
Yeah. So you had this skill, this ability to relate to people and to understand not just their crime, but to understand them.
Yeah.
But isn't that also kind of a liability to you? Doesn't that come at a cost?
Yeah. Well, and I think the way I used to look at it is, you know, and some people say, and we'll talk about maybe my organized crime career a bit later, but some people say, you know, you're too trusting with these individuals, or you're sharing too much information. But here's what I learned in my time. I do believe, and I would say this in the US and the UK, and perhaps people, your international listeners, might relate this to whatever country they're listening in, is that the system is also broken, that the very system that is designed to protect us as citizens also fails a lot of these people, and we put them in jails, and we hope that they're going to be rehabilitated, but we don't give them the tools and resources and the skills to be successful. So I might have opened myself up a little bit more to some of these individuals than maybe what other detectives did.
Yeah.
But I never did it in a way to jeopardize my safety, but I did it from understanding that perhaps this system isn't really designed to help them. You know, we put someone in prison for 10, 15 years, and when they leave, we give them a check for $200 and say, well done, go out into society and don't do that again. But we haven't really helped them become a better person and give them skills. That makes sense, Jared?
Yes, and that's wonderful policing, but I'm curious what cost that has to you personally. What kind of a toll did that take on you to, you know, to extend that kind of empathy to people?
Yeah,
that's going to cost you.
Well, and something that happened. So my younger brother in the UK had his first daughter. Ruby's about, she just turned two. So I should know more about this than what I do. But Ruby just turned 2 years old. And my brother Ricky, he has a really stressful job in the UK. He is a clever guy, master's degrees, all this type of stuff. But he oversees social workers that have to go into police stations when someone's been sectioned on a mental health hold. My brother supervises a team that says, yes, this person is a danger to themselves or to others, or they're, you know, they're safe in the community. And when he had his daughter, Ruby, my niece, literally 1 or 2 days after Ruby was born, he went into work because there was some disaster or something happened and they needed him. And I said to my dear mother, who's recently turned 82, I said, you know, Ricky hasn't worked it out yet, has he? And she said, no, what does he need to work out? And I said, you can only save the ones that you can save. I said, he can't save everyone. I said, he needs to be at home with Ruby. And so at the same time, Jared, as me opening and softening my heart, there was also this hardness which does come with law enforcement, where you also get closed off knowing that I cannot save everyone. I just have to focus on those people that I can save. And that's how you change a broken system. That's how you change a society, is take one step at a time. So again, my experience allowed me to sort of educate my brother and say, hey, you know, you're going to put yourself into an early grave trying to do this because you've got to save the ones that you can save. And I think that ties into the time, Jared, when the woman died in my arms. And I've told you about that previously as well.
You served as a detective in Thames Valley, but then you had an opportunity to kind of advance your career. Can you tell me about that change to in what your work was?
Yeah, and so Melvin Young was the detective chief superintendent that said, Simon, I think you should be a detective. Mark Jones was the detective chief inspector that he went to and said, Simon hasn't applied, tell him to come back in here. And again, you know, you look back on your life and you say, there was a mature man who was course correcting, who was guiding my career. And Mark Jones himself had spent a long time in organized crime, covert policing. So in the UK, we don't have federal law enforcement. So I'm a little bit of a novelty here in the US because we used to do covert entries, which for your non-police listeners means we used to break into people's houses. We'd break into people's cars and plant listening devices. We would do the surveillance. We would do what you call wiretap, which is for sort of listening to phone conversations. Right. We would prosecute our sort of cases. So Mark Jones had done all those things. And then when he went back into that, he sort of almost called me and said, Simon, this is a perfect fit for you to work into organized crime, to do these more substantial investigations, long-term investigations of a covert nature. And again, I think I was 24. 24, 25. I was like, sure, why not? Let's go. What harm can it good? Yeah, maybe I was 25, 26.
What did he see in you? Now, the first time they saw your empathy and your ability to connect. What are they seeing this time? Your ability to break into things?
Well, yeah. I left in 2011. Are we outside the law here? I think what they saw the second time was most probably my ability to make difficult decisions under pressure. Hmm. And also to be able to process data quickly and make decisions. So when you are doing surveillance, when you're doing covert entries, when you're doing these long-term investigations, there's a lot of data that you're getting from. It could be from wiretap, listening to someone's conversations, or information from surveillance when you're following someone, or their financial information. You know, you have to process this data quickly and see the bigger picture and be creative. And so I think it was all those type of things that they then saw into me and said this would be a good fit. And again, it was. Like I said, I was commended 14 times in a police department that has 6,000 sworn officers. At the time I left, that was unheard of. So I was definitely doing something.
Doing something right.
Doing something right in there, yeah.
So was terrorism also a part of that same unit's responsibility, or was that something different?
Yeah, and so what happened? It was super interesting how this came about. So in 2005, it was, I was doing an animal rights extremism case. And animal rights groups are a fascinating jab because they are incredibly good at infiltration. And when they get hold of these organizations that they believe are doing unlawful animal testing or are creating these products, you know, they will go to the nth degree to really destroy that person's life. That's what they do. So we were doing an infiltration into an animal rights group, and it was highly sensitive. I can say that at the time, Tony Blair was the Prime Minister of England, and part of our direction came from Parliament, as in we need this activist, we need these under control. And so my clearance level was like super, super high. I think in the US you have, I can't remember, like top secret, you might call it, in the
right,
US.
Right.
I had the equivalent in the UK for doing this animal rights extremism. You know, you can't tell anyone what you're doing. And so we did this long investigation into these animal rights infiltration. And then post 9/11 in the UK, we created a lot of terrorism laws, which gave the police powers to do things that ordinarily the public might say, well, you shouldn't be doing that level of infiltration into people's personal lives. And then what happened, MI5, through, I believe, wiretap, they got sort of wind, you might say, of this extremist, these British-born Muslims extremists, which were intended to do something really creative, was when everyone tries to blow up the plane by taking the bomb onto the plane, why don't we make the bomb when we're actually on the plane? Which I don't think anyone in history has ever actually tried to do that before. So this came about that the MI5, which is homegrown terrorism, MI6 is foreign terrorism, they got wind of this sort of plot. And it was the first time that they'd actually said post 9/11, well, actually, rather than just stopping this plot, and if people don't know what happened in 2006, these British-born Muslim extremists were intended to make a bomb on board planes which were destined for America, and then detonate them on board. And obviously that's what changed aviation security worldwide, limiting liquids on planes. That's why the reason you can't take more than 100 milliliters on planes today.
So Simon, you're the reason I've got to put all my little liquids into a bag.
Yes.
It's your fault.
And you know how hard it is sometimes. I mean, every person has a little bit of an ego, like a regular. Do you know how hard it is for me, Jack, when I go through TSA and I forget a bottle of water and they say, you're not allowed that? I want to say to them, can I tell you why? Because I'm part of it. You know? I feel like I've got to tell them the story and stuff.
I was there. Yes.
Yeah, I was there doing surveillance on these people, bad people. But so it was the first time that the British said, well, actually, rather than use this as intelligence, we can prosecute these individuals by turning it into a criminal investigation. And because my level, my clearance level was so high from doing the animal rights extremist case, I then jumped into the liquid bomb terrorism plot. We did a lot of surveillance on the subjects, did a lot of observation posts and a lot of other stuff I can't really sort of talk about, nor should I. I don't want people to come and find me here in the US. but it was an interesting case. And that's really how it happened. I mean, luck, judgment. I would say it was hard work and determination that put me in those windows of opportunities, which gave me some of those very high profile cases. So that's how the terrorism sort of then came. And obviously, the world has changed very much since 2006. There's been numerous, a lot of terrorism or potential acts of terrorism since that day.
Well, all of that experience, and I'm sure a lot more, led to your post-law enforcement career. And I want to talk to you about that another day.
Yeah.
But can we circle back around to the empathy that you had, the people who were guiding you and helping you and forming what kind of person you were? Because a lot of police officers really have an us versus them with the population at large, and especially criminals.
Yeah.
And if someone is convicted of a crime, they are alien. They are other.
Yeah.
And yet I know that you actually became friends with a criminal. Can you tell me that story?
Yes, yeah. And it's interesting what you say, because I think as people, it is easy to judge. It is easy to make assumptions about people's lives, but we've never really walked, and I don't want to get too cliche here, Jared, but we've never walked in their shoes, have we? So we don't understand. I mean, I think all of us, and you know, your listeners might not know, I'm actually sort of, you know, black and English, or black English American now. We all have privilege to some degree over someone else. So we can all always look at someone else's life and say, well, they've had it easy. You know, we don't fully understand their journey. And it's interesting how this story came about, Jared. So picture me as a young detective. So this is 2003 now. So I'm 23, 24 years old. Already getting a reputation as being a little bit of an English terrier, but you know, I don't let anything go, and you know, I'm happy to work 15, 16, 17 hours in stuff to hunt down these criminals. And my detective sergeant at the time was a guy called Nick Watts, and he walked over to me, and I kid you not, this is what he said. He said, "Simon, I'm going to give you a case." He said, "You're going to effing hate this guy by the end of it, but I think you're the right person." And I was like, Nick, that's a little bit harsh, you know. So like, what's he got? And I looked at the papers, and it was a guy called Michael Long, who, as you mentioned, I've gone on to become good friends with. Serial fraudster, criminal, does a lot of white-collar crime, and had spent many, many years in and out of incarceration. Really, really sort of bad person. And what had happened to Nick was that when he investigated Michael Long, he'd found out where he lived. He sat outside his house. He followed him around and just skirted just enough under the law to say, "I know everything about you." And it was an intimidation factor. Huh. And I saw, I was like, yeah, I don't really mind this, let's go. And I did all the preliminary investigation, and we went around at maybe like 5 o'clock in the morning to arrest this Michael Long, knocked on the door. And the first thing he said to me, so bear in mind, I'm a young detective for your listeners, 23, 24 years old. And Michael's a couple of years older than me. So at the time he would have been sort of 26, 27. Okay. And he said, "This isn't what you do." And I said, "What do you mean?" You know, I said, "You're under arrest. You're coming down the station." He said, no, "You ring me and I come to the police station by appointment." And I just looked at him and said, "I don't know who you think you're talking to, but that isn't the game that I play. Get your coat. You're coming down the station." So he had purchased a Porsche, which was out of fraud. We recovered the car. And then over the next series of several months, I did the investigation. He was arrested and bailed. We had information from informants that says Michael Long knows where Simon lives, he knows where his mother lives, and he's going to go around and have someone kneecap his mother, you know. And so you know, my mum would have been in like, you know, late 50s at the time, maybe something like that. And for me, as a young detective, I was like, yes, we've got him. You know, we've got him, because when he was going all out to try and stop me, that said, you've got this guy, Simon. You've got him on the
road. You're pushing his buttons.
Pushing our buttons. And, you know, and there was a lots of disclosure and things that he said, you know, like he would, during interviews, he would say, you know, why do you run to the train station in the morning? Indicating to me that he'd had someone follow me, so he clearly knew where I lived. And he made all these other disclosures about people that I worked with. And it caused me to look at my colleagues saying, is someone feeding him information here? You know, what is, how is he knowing these things about my personal life? So really, really bad guy. And he ends up, I literally threw the book at him, Jared. I think there was like 60 or 70 charges of like fraud and deception, something like this. Right. And he ends up going to prison for 5 years for those crimes. And then when he came out, I've left the sort of general detective office. I'm now doing organized crime and terrorism, you know, these type of sort of sneaky stuff. And then people would ring me and say, this is Officer so-and-so. We've just arrested this person, Michael Long. When we searched his home or his car, we found your home address or your telephone number or found this information about you. We've obviously checked who you are and we're just sort of wanting to let you know. And I said, don't worry about it. I said, Michael's my nemesis. This is just what he does. He tries to intimidate, you know, just ignore it because that's what I do. That's just what he's like. So he had this reputation of being my nemesis. Every time someone would ring me, I'd say, like, throw the book at him. This is how you get him. Lots of charges, make him plea and stuff like this. And so I must have had 5, 6, 7 calls over the years from someone that said, I've just arrested him and they've either got my personal details or can you give us some advice? So everyone knew this guy was my nemesis. And so when you fast forward most probably 15 years later, something like that, one of my friends who was a detective, he sent me a news article saying that Michael Long was now out of prison. He had found faith as a Christian and that he was doing this charity work for the homeless. And my friend sent me the article, and I think, to pardon the pun for your listeners, but just to swear, my friend called book it and said, you know, there's a scam. And I looked at it thought, I know this guy's date of birth. I know everything. I know more about him than he knows himself. I was looking at it thinking, I just can't see where's the scam, because if any of your listeners are involved in a non-profit or a charity trying to get money out of people, it can be like getting blood out of a stone. So I was thinking, yes, where's the scam for this guy who's turned to faith? And if he's trying to rob people. But something came over me that said, ring him up, Simon, and find out. And it was like 6:30 in the morning. I was working in corporate America in finance. And I did some research, you know, very highly skilled detective, wasn't difficult to find him. Found him online, found his telephone number. And it was like 6:30 in the morning. And I called him up and I rang the number and he answered. And I said, is that Michael Long? And he said, yes. And I said, you might not remember me, but I said, my name is Simon Osmar. I said, I used to be a detective and I put you in prison for 5 years. And then he said, I remember you. I effing hated you. What are you calling me for? And I said, well, Michael, I said, someone's just sent me this article of you doing this charity work. And I said, I'm just ringing up to say that I always knew that if you harnessed everything you had for bad, if you harnessed it for good, you didn't need the crime, you'd be successful. And I said, I just want to say that I'm proud of you. And it's really hard to explain the emotion, but he said, I've got to stop because I'm driving. And then he pulled over at the side of the road and I heard the crack in his voice go. And then he then started crying down the phone. And I listened to him cry for 2 minutes, 2 or 3 minutes, and we continued the conversation. And then we left the conversation, and instantly he sent me a text message. And he said, I don't know if your family knew what I was doing to intimidate you during that time, but can you tell your family that I'm sorry and can they forgive me? And I just texted him back and said, Michael, you don't need forgiveness. I said, just keep walking towards the light. Just keep doing the good things, and I'll be here for you. And my dear mother, who just turned 82 this year, I told her when this happened. This is now sort of 5, 6, 7 years ago when this happened. I told her, bearing in mind, this was a guy who was going to send someone around in the dead of night to kneecap her. My mother, who's a lifelong Christian, said, tell him I forgive him. Tell him I forgive him. And that was a really powerful moment for me to message Michael and say, my dear mother forgives you. Just let it go. And then we spoke, became friends. We did a BBC interview together, and I found we had more in common than actually separated us.
Yeah.
And here's how it all comes together, Jared, is that when he was in prison, he wrote a book. And his book, I've still got his book. At some time, I might even use some of the stuff in there to write a book and share about the story. And I think the book was called something like There Is a Way Out. Michael sent it to me and said, Simon, can you edit and sort of, you know, redo this book? I said, well, I'll take a read and see. And in the first two pages of the book, it really said how my entire life had been shaped from Melvin Young saying, I see something in you. It became very clear in reading Michael's book, because on the first page of the book, it said something similar to this. All I ever wanted was to feel validated and accepted by my father, and it never came. And so I turned to crime, and the bigger crime that I did, the bigger validation that I got, but the validation was never enough. And then it hit me, Jared, all those years previously, as to why we've had this cat and mouse and why we'd had this nemesis with each other, is that he was exactly the same as me. He was a man that grew up with a father who was present but wasn't present in his life. I had a father who wasn't present, and we were both two scared little boys. We just took very different paths. And it was a really powerful moment that everything from someone placing faith in me led to that moment. I said to Michael, I said, I don't care if you commit crime again, if you make mistakes. I said, what I want you to know is that I'm here for you. And if ever you need me, if it's 2 o'clock in the morning, you've done something wrong, or you feel like you're going to do something wrong, I said, ring me first and let's have a conversation, because I've made a decision, Michael, that I'm going to be there for you. I'm going to support you, whatever that looks like. And he did post. He did call me on a couple of occasions saying, I feel like I'm going to do something I shouldn't, or can we talk this through? And yep. I could offer him that rationale voice that not a lot of these people have. He might have posted something on Facebook and I read it and I texted him and said, Michael, not cool. I would delete that for these reasons, deal with that matter privately. And so my entire life really was shaped through that sequence of events, which led me and Michael now to be very, very good friends. And a lot of people still struggle to understand it, but it's really important to know, if not me, then who? If I'm not going to place faith in that person, then who is? And there's been numerous times, Jared, post this, in 2019, post this, I was in London with work and I got off London Underground and someone approached me and I was thinking, am I going to be robbed? Am I going to be insulted? What's going to happen? And this person asked me for some money. I said, look, I generally don't have any money, but then Michael Long came to my mind. If not me, then who? And I said to this person late at night, dark outside a subway station, I said, I don't have any money to give you, but I said, I'm willing to talk to you and just listen to your story. And by the end of it, after like 20, 30 minutes, this person I thought was going to rob me or wanted money for drugs, whatever it was, he was crying on my shoulder, on my shoulder. And I said to him, I said, what are you crying for? And he said, you're the first person today that's actually made me feel like I exist and my life is significant. And all that came down to was Michael Long. If not me, then who? If I'm not going to lean into this difficult situation, who then is? And I know this isn't a Christian podcast, but that's heavy in my faith that the Lord corrected me and steered me from a young age, from everything I was seeking was the validation of a father. But still now, as I talked to you, Jared, 46 years old, still never met my human father that brought me into the world, but the Lord has sure as hell given me strong men which have corrected me and given me the life skills that I've needed to be successful. So there's a lot in there to unpack.
Simon, last question. How does all of this, your time in law enforcement and all of your experiences since, how does it affect you as a father now?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's certain things that I've learned, because never having a father figure, it's really hard to understand, well, what is the right path to take? Because I'm almost living life as a man without a rule book or without a guide. And sometimes I might have to go to Home Depot, with any international listeners, it's like a sort of a large hardware store, and buy something. And my wife will say to me, are you going to take the boys with you? I've got two sons. I'm like, why am I going to take the boys? She's like, well, to teach them what they need to do. I'm like, oh yeah, I guess I should. I mean, so there's sometimes these funny moments where I catch myself thinking, well, actually, yeah, I should mostly teach my son something. But it's hard because I've been living my life without a rule book. So it's greatly affected me to understand that, you know, you can change broken systems. You can change people by placing faith in them and just by taking one step at a time. And I think for me as a father, I feel like I get it wrong more than what I get it right. But what I'm teaching my sons is that we're all equal. Everyone has privilege to some degree. And the question is, what are you going to use, or how are you going to use the skills that the Lord has given you for the benefit of other people? And so I think my time in law enforcement, my faith as a Christian, and Michael Long has really taught me that the Lord has given me certain skills and attributes, and I need to use those to help inspire, lead, and encourage other people, even when I might not feel like doing that myself. It's really important to say to someone, hey, you might not see this, Jared, but I see this in you. You know, you're having a hard time now, but there is a path. There is a way forward. So I think all that's given me an awful lot. As I started this podcast, Jared, it's really the police force made me the man that I am today, and I'll always be incredibly grateful for that the Lord put me into that position.
Simon, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your story. I really appreciated it.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, Jared. And I love what you do. I love this podcast. I love listening. And I just appreciate you allowing me the opportunity to give your listeners an insight into my life. So I appreciate you doing that.
I loved talking to Simon again and getting to know him better. He is yet another example of a cop who used empathy and high levels of communication to serve his community. And I'm also a sucker for great leadership stories in law enforcement. So when a police supervisor really makes a difference guiding the life and career of a junior officer, well, that just warms the cockles of my heart. Those interactions do happen, and they could be encouraged to happen more, but we're going to have to be deliberate in leadership training and mentoring. And a lot of times that gets pushed to the back burner when things are really busy. On the next episode of Hey Chaplain.
We have to do better at keeping those people around that have incredible knowledge. Maybe they are ready to be done with the job that they're in now, but where can we transition that experience and knowledge into, maybe it's not a position of leadership, but an informal one? Especially a guy who's worked hard and has kind of been in the front line his entire career. The last thing he wants to hear is, oh, you're going to an admin role. Put him in a position where he is still part of that team or a team, where he can share that knowledge and experience.
If you like this episode, please share it with a cop or someone who loves a cop. The views expressed here are the personal views of the host and our guest and do not necessarily represent the views of any law enforcement agency or its components. Thank you for listening to Hey Chaplain. And as always, pray for peace in our city.